Today we have a very special guest, Edward Sproul. He is the inspiration behind this show, Humans of Microsoft. At 27, he lost his leg in an accident. At 37, he found himself in a prison with no education. Let's pause for a minute and let it seep in. At 37, he is in prison without any education. Today, he is a senior engineer in Microsoft. He has a bachelor's in computer engineering. He has a master's in engineering. He ran 40 triathlons, many Ironman, and he biked from Seattle to Portland, which is almost 200 miles. Let's meet the Ironman.
Very funny.
Welcome to our show,
Ed. It's good to be here.
Thank you for doing this for us. Let's start from the beginning. Where was your childhood, and what about your siblings, parents?
Well, right there, you're making an assumption that my childhood was behind me. Because I look at, I'm still having a long, happy childhood. I see no need to rush these things. When I was younger, we lived on a farm, a rural farm, very far from the city. I didn't really have any friends there. It was our family, a few close neighbors that we knew a little bit. So growing up for me was kind of an isolated thing, and I don't think this is a real good deal for people. I think you need to have those communication skills and interaction skills. So the only role models I had were my parents, and my parents really wanted to do the best that they could. They believed in their heart they could do the best that they could. But I continually saw the striving to be something that they really probably weren't quite cut out to be. And they were growing in places they probably shouldn't be. And watching that as a kid gave me the idea that that's the way I should go. For parents, you can tell your kids anything you want, but they're going to learn from what you do. And I obviously had parents who wanted to be very good role models, but they weren't. And as kids, you see everything they do. As I got older, they strived to climb the economic ladder. We sold the farm. We went into the restaurant business. And my dad was turning to be quite the stewardship of his waitresses and things. There was a lot of things that went on in our family that I saw and just thought, oh, that's the way it should be. And it kind of guided me off to thinking that I needed these material things, and I would the girls and things like that were going to make my life happy, and I chased off after the wrong things very hard. And the more you do to try to fit into a crowd that you don't belong in, the worse it can get. Mm-hmm. And my life continued that way for quite a while. Through high school, I started drinking to fit in with a certain group of people. I started doing drugs because I thought it would be cool. And it was all about trying to have friends that I didn't have when I was a kid and try to make up for those kind of things. As I look back on it, I think that's what drove the drugs and the alcohol and the behavior. By eighth grade, I had a shoplifting record that was pretty bad. Mm. I ended up in juvenile court. All through high school, I was drinking. Was lucky enough to get into the University of Pittsburgh because my parents knew a state senator that helped me get in. And once I got there, I found I was the cool man on campus if I had all the drugs. Mm. So that's where life really took a turn. When you're doing these things, when you're in the middle of them, you don't realize it. When you look back 20, 30, 40 years later, or you get a wake-up call, like I like to call it, you tend to realize that this destructive behavior that you're in the middle of isn't right. Good. One of my probably most famous sayings that I really, if I was going to put it on a billboard, would put it on a billboard: if you find yourself in a hole, maybe you should stop digging.
Yes.
And I kept digging further and further, and the older I got, the less under any type of accountability of any sort. I lived a long ways in California away from my parents, so I could do anything I wanted. Again, turned to selling drugs, drinking, joined a motorcycle gang. Mm. And because I fit in, as a youngster, I didn't fit in well. And I think I was still trying to fit in, and I was trying to fit in all the wrong places. Mm. And this behavior is what ended up the late night drinking after the bar closed and the wreck that I lost my leg. And eventually trying to pay my bills, I landed in prison.
And you were at 27 when that accident
happened. I was at 27. We were out drinking at a bar, and we had a fifth of peppermint schnapps, and we knew we couldn't carry the bottle once we opened it, so we figured we'd drink it. Yeah, that's pretty much. I've been asked many times, why would you ride a motorcycle that drunk? I said, well, I was too drunk to walk. How else was I going to get home?
Oh, yeah.
So I got on a motorcycle, and we were racing down the street, and I had a brake line go out. So I thought, oh, this is just an accident. I'll get over it. And I kept living a crazy life. Right. So instead of drinking, I turned to drugs heavily.
And you lost your leg in that accident.
I lost my leg in that accident. My friends came over to carry me up, cover me up. They thought I was dead. I was in the street, and I kind of rolled over complaining that my hip hurt. They said, yeah, I'll bet it does. And one of my friends put a tourniquet on my leg, and they saved me from bleeding out right there in the street.
Right.
And I eventually recovered.
Wow. And for anybody, that can be the lowest point in their life when they lose the leg.
Yeah, I think I've always had a very positive hope for the future. I've never gotten like, oh, I can't get out of this mess, or I can't get over it. But waking up with your leg in traction is definitely pretty cool. My mother came out and spent some time with me and tried to talk to me about changing my life. Mm-hmm. They had changed their life and became Christians and were doing much better in their family. And after, even with all the adultery and everything in their past, they had pulled themselves back together. They were now marriage counselors. They were helping other people with their problems. And she came out and spent considerable time with me while I was in the hospital, but I'm still thinking I'm going to be okay. This is just a mistake. I'll be all right. I had a couple of friends that were also missing a leg. And they would come by, and I could see that, you know, I'm going to be okay at some point. So it didn't push me down quite as far as maybe it should have.
It should have.
I like to say God was trying to get my attention, but I wasn't listening yet.
True.
It wasn't until 10 years later in 1991, I'd gotten financially behind. I'd always do this. I wouldn't pay my house payment for several months, and I needed to make some money, so I took a load of drugs to Florida from California. And that's where I was arrested. And that, when the first they arrested us, they put us in Walton County Jail, and that's kind of a not so bad place. I was okay with that. Still, that positive attitude coming out that I think it's going to be okay, I'm going to get out of here any day. Then about 6 days after we were there, the federal marshal showed up, and they shackled us up, put us in their vans, and took us down to Escambia County Jail. And that's not a nice place. That's when I really hit the bottom. That's when I knew that I was in a hole and I was still digging.
Right.
And that's not how you get out of a hole.
And you got for 6 years sentence.
Yeah, I was sentenced to 72 months in federal prison. Out of that 72 months in federal prison, I served, 4 years and 10 months. So that's 58 of the 72 months. And during that time, I believe God has a sense of humor. He locked me up with a guy who had a PhD in mathematics.
Right.
And I kind of just traded addictions, which I find in life we have talents, we have things that we can use for positive, and you can use the same things for negative. At that point, I started studying math, and I realized I could. To flip back, in the early years in grade school, I used to sit and play with numbers all the time. And I'd get in all kinds of trouble because I couldn't spell and I couldn't conjugate verbs or whatever they called it. They'd draw word diagrams, and that made no sense to me at all. But you give me math, and I figured it out. I was good at it. But no one picked this out.
Right.
No one ever saw that, hey, maybe we should give up on conjugating verbs and try a little algebra. Never worked out that way. But once I got hooked up with Dr. Reed, I realized that, hey, I could do this. And he was a super motivator. He would teach math to anybody, anyone. He would convince them that they were going to be Albert Einstein. And we got going, and I never looked back. So it's been quite a journey.
So what keep you motivated in the prison to keep learning? Because even if I go to school, math is not that easy.
No.
And you're learning very unconventional way.
Yeah. I think it comes down to your personality and your hunger and your drive. A lot of times you just really got to be tired of what you're doing and mad at it. I mean, I look back I had money, I had a nice house, I had things going on, but it wasn't right.
Mm.
And I knew that I wanted some of the good things, but right. I knew that I couldn't have it the way that I had it.
Right.
And I wanted to do it the right way. So my whole goal was to just learn enough math to where I could program the computer-controlled machines to do machine work and build motorcycle parts, which is, I was heavy into motorcycle repair. I was a motorcycle mechanic. And I thought if I learned a little bit of math, I could run these machines. So I got motivated. Then I found out I could. And the next thing you know, I'm studying, you know, advanced calculus on my own in a jail cell. So I ended up building those computer-controlled machines for Rockwell Automation at one point in my life.
Wow.
And that was, I've always kind of liked to just keep learning.
Right.
Well, I told the judge when he sentenced me, I didn't care where he sent me, but just somewhere where I could get education. And that was a point in time where our prison system was clamping down. They did not want inmates getting educated. They did not want to make it look like the inmates were coddled by any stretch of the imagination. They wanted it to make it look like they were being punished. So it was very difficult. I had a person there that was hired from the outside to proctor tests for GED and ABE. These are basic education classes. And the Federal Bureau of Prisons said everybody has to do that. Well, I've got so one piece that fell into place is I've got a legitimate test proctor there. So then I found correspondence courses where they would send you the book and send you the course outline. But even then, the prison system wouldn't allow me to get the materials. So what we found was we could send them to the education department inside the prison, and they would call me to tell me to take the book up and put it in the library. Yes, ma'am, I will do that as soon as I'm done with it. And that's how I took three terms of physics and differential equations and these kind of classes by getting a book and an outline. But keep in mind, I had Dr. Zadok Reed
with me
in there. Okay. I also had Dr. Kavourier, who has his PhD in physics from Caltech.
Oh, wow.
So I had my own little private university going on here.
Wow, that's, yeah.
Yeah, they were both genuine educators and both genuine felons. So we were all in the boat together, but I think they kind of got a kick out of me because I would just devour anything I got my hands on. I had nothing but time.
True.
And that's what I did. I studied. First, I studied my Bible. I got my life right. And then the rest came quite easy.
Perfect. Yeah.
But you needed a foundation to be able to do any
of
this.
Right. So I'm just wondering what you will say to your younger self if you'll meet him like at 10 year or 15.
I thought about that a bit at times. Like, what would the bigger question I have is, what would I have listened to? And I think at 10 years old, you don't listen to what you're told, but you listen to what you see. Okay? And if a person is trying to be impressionable on a 10-year-old, it's not what they're going to tell them that's going to be the difference. It's going to be how you live in front of that 10-year-old. But the problems were basically taking destructive behavior and believing that this was good, that there was a better positive that was going to come out of it, and it's just very wrong. It just doesn't work out that way.
True.
We lost a lot of people back in those years over destructive behavior.
True.
Jimi Hendrix to Janis Joplin, and then the list goes on and on.
True.
We still lose a few now and then today, but back then it seemed like every week we were losing Elvis or somebody.
Yeah. So you turned your life around completely, like 180 degrees, from rock bottom to, you know, masters and being here.
Well, I believe God turned my life around. The other thing I might put on a billboard is God has a plan.
God has a plan.
And when you start believing that and you start seeing the things unfold that happened in my life, I don't have another explanation for it. I couldn't have put Dr. Reed and Dr. Kavourier there. You know, if people don't like the way they're going, you know, well, they probably won't be blessed with losing a leg or blessed with going to prison. But sometimes when you're in the bottom of a pit hole, the things that are going to happen to you, you need to be able to have the ability to make the positive out or see that this is the right thing that you want to do.
True.
And when I came to that realization that there's something better, that I'm capable of something better, Another thing very disturbing is to ever see a parent running a kid down. You're worthless, you're youthless, you're not, and a parent thinking he's going to make his child better or that relationship by doing those kind of things. It's just totally the opposite. Once a person believes that he can't do something, he can't.
True.
And the person that believes he can. And this has been said for many, many years, but I had a mom that told me I could be anything I wanted over and over and over again. And I believe that's the reason that I had the drive that I've got, or the type A minus. I have to quote my friend Stacy. Uh-huh. I'm type A minus. A plus runs out and does it. I run out, I'm ready, and occasionally I do it. I got a kick out of that.
Yeah.
I mean, go ahead.
So the people who are watching us and maybe, you know, struggling into similar situations.
Uh-huh.
So the message for them is don't lose hope.
Don't lose hope. Again, back to that, if you're doing something destructive that's dragging your life down, or something that's dragging your life down, maybe you need to stop.
True.
And everybody says, wow, that sounds hard. It is. It's not. I probably would have never changed my ways if I hadn't got locked up, but I'm hoping that people listening don't have to go through that experience.
Right.
But there's ways to change your life while you're in the midst of it. There's people to help. I don't know what kind of problems we may be addressing. You know, drugs, there's obviously recovery programs. I've been very blessed to be able to lead a financial class and see the money problems that people go through and discuss money problems that people go through. There's help.
True.
There's people that want to help you do better.
Right.
You also have to be careful with people wanting to help you do better with your money. True. Make sure they're not helping you out of your money.
True. So when you came out of prison and you had this education and you went back to the college, but our system is not that easy for people to get jobs back again after having all these records. So how did you overcome those obstacles? And when people didn't believe in you, what did you say to yourself? And what did you say to them?
I was asked this question a few weeks ago, like, how did you handle the interview process? And I was asked to go into the Monroe facility and talk to the inmates there, but we're getting a little bit of computer education. They were getting out. And how did you handle the interview process? I don't recall having any confrontation about it. The best advice I can give you, if you've got a past that you feel is going to hold you back in the job market or the education market, the key is to put some space of positive things between that. From the time I came out of prison, I was in a halfway house, and the only thing on my record in a halfway house is, well, he sneaks out and goes to college. And they busted me. They busted me going to Case Western. I was supposed to be working, and I didn't know what to tell them, and they didn't know what to tell me, and they let me finish the term of school and then made me come back to the halfway house like I was being disciplined.
Right.
I was just, you've got to put some space of positive things between the negative. And that, I think I had a bachelor's degree, a master's degree. I got hired as an intern with Rockwell Automation, and they just kept me on. I also think I was blessed that I didn't have anything violent in my past. I would be very, very difficult to be able to come out with a violent felony. They would have never let me into Case Western. At each stage, what did happen, I applied to Case, and then I didn't hear anything. And eventually when my mother contacted them, they said, oh, it's being held up by legal. So legal had to go through the ramifications of making sure I wasn't going to be a problem. If I would have had any type of violence in my past, they couldn't let me sit next to another student who was paying a lot of money to be there, just as I was. But they couldn't let me in the classrooms. The same thing happened when I was hired by Microsoft. I checked the box that I'm a felon. They called me up. They made my offer. I told Rockwell politely I was leaving. Okay. And then about noon that day, I got a call from Microsoft saying, your offer's being held up. I said, let me paint you a picture. I'm standing on a bridge. Well, I just blew up one end of it. You need to get me in there. And he said, Ed, it's got to go through legal. I'm sure that it'll be approved. But it was really the seventh hour, the last day that it actually got approved. And they got me in a moving van and moved me out to Microsoft.
Right.
But it was definitely a stressful time. So the legal aspects of having a felony are very, very real.
Right, right.
But if you put the positive between the bad, they're going to look at what you did last.
True, true. And in Microsoft, how was your interview process in Microsoft?
Brutal.
Okay.
I failed. I failed like a dog. I was working at Rockwell, and I had applied to Microsoft 3 times, I think it was. Mm-hmm. The first time was a simple application. It didn't go anywhere. The second time, I actually got a walk-in interview, and I had just interviewed for Rockwell. Well, Rockwell's a very starchy place, shirt mm-hmm. and ties, no, you got to wear shoes and things like that. So I walked in with a shirt and a tie to a Microsoft interview, and the interviewer just looked at me like, "You're a college hire? Mm. I'm 44. And I could just see him like just checked out. I knew this wasn't going anywhere. So we went through the interview, and I nicely got the letter. We found someone with better qualifications to meet our whatever. Mm. Basically, they said no. Then I had my first review at Rockwell, and it was, you got to remember, the year 2000 was heavy tech, mm-hmm. and it was very, very good markets for jobs at that time. The dot-coms were hiring people, paying crazy money. So I went all through the interview process, and by the time they took back the money that they'd given me in insurance costs, I got like $38 a month. And I asked them if it was negotiable, and they said no. So I sent my application to a friend that worked at Microsoft, and she submitted it internally. And I think I had some contact from a recruiter. Mm. But then a friend of mine who was doing recruiting came back that worked at Microsoft, another friend, brought the recruiter with him to recruit at Case Western. And we went out for dinner, and she goes, "I think I was supposed to call you like a month ago." Mm. So we talked during that dinner, and she got to know me a little bit. And it wasn't long until they flew me out. But when they flew me out, I got on a plane with a friend of mine. I knew nothing about the Microsoft interview process. Mm. Zero. Didn't think anything of it. I got on the plane, and he's studying all kinds of questions that he'd copied off of the web. Mm-hmm. I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm getting ready for the interview." "Well, what are you expecting?" Mm. "Oh," and then he told me about the Microsoft interview process. I'm like, "Really? Well, I don't think they'll do that because I've been working at Rockwell." So wrong. So I interviewed for a developer position, and I just failed it badly. Uh-huh, I think I got nervous, probably. I also, I had
the whiteboard.
I had a sweater, and a nice button-down shirt on. Uh-huh. I've learned the worse you dress, the better you may do. Uh-huh. So now we've gone from the suit to the sweater. I've got the interview. I do really badly, but they transferred me over to program management interview, mm-hmm. and I did really, really well. Mm. It was more abstract problems, a little bit less of whiteboard coding, and more of your thinking about goofy problems. Well, I got a goofy mind. You give me a goofy problem, you'll get a goofy solution. But we had a lot of fun, and I had a lot of fun with the NetDocs folks back in 2000. Mm. I did not get an offer, but the market was so hot at that time, they offered to fly me back out for interviews as a program manager and an SDET, mm-hmm. and I got hires all across the board. The second time I was prepared. Uh-huh. Oh yeah, trick me once, it's my fault. Trick me twice, no. Right. I came back out, I was prepared. I practiced just about every problem you could think of and could uh-huh. find on the web. But mostly just practice a routine to go through to get the problem to a solution, any problem.
True.
I got offers from the office folks, and I got offers from the Windows shell, and I did not want to be a program manager. It just does not fit me. Right. I'm a code junkie. I just love to dig into problems. As a kid, they bought me toys I could tear apart because I would tear them apart.
Right.
And I still, today, I'm figuring out how stuff works. And if you don't have that inquisitive type of nature, Microsoft probably has a job for you, but I don't know what it is.
So you did a couple of attempts in Microsoft. Do you have any advice for people who are trying to get in Microsoft?
I have some advice to do what you're good at. Mm-hmm. And if you're not the type of person that, if someone gives you a problem and you can't sleep till you get it done, if it just drives you crazy trying to find solutions to problems, through college, I was like that. The taking courses in thermodynamics and dynamics and stuff that has nothing to do with computers, but I would sit and work these crazy problems until I found the right solution. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have that type of mentality to really drive to the finish line, in my particular field, in the engineering and software development, it's going to be very, very hard.
True.
I mean, you can be very, very smart and get by and not be passionate about it.
Right.
But most of the people I work with, you'll find underneath them a passion to solve problems. So if you don't have that, you may want to look for something else.
True.
There's definitely other companies that do different things.
True. And I believe you worked in a shell team in Windows.
I did. I worked in the fishbowl, I called it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was a user interface of Windows for 14 years and 4 months, and I almost know how many hours.
Mm-hmm.
It was fun. I enjoyed the people I was with, but it's a very, very highlighted job.
Mm-hmm.
If you make a mistake in that arena, the whole world will know about it.
Right.
If it gets out of your building anyways.
So any particular feature you own?
Oh, the start panel, the start menu, the Windows 8 notification pipeline. Our team owned the start menu, the taskbar, all the user interface. The first thing I worked on were what's called the common controls, which are a library of things that we use to build all the UI.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, I spent about 2 to 3 years working with the media player team.
Mm.
Which was kind of fun, but it was the user interface of the media player. I didn't work, that's scary, the stuff
right.
below the media player.
Right.
I didn't work on that.
Okay. And now you work in the build team.
We've got some big problems that are definitely hold us back as a company and great business need there. But it's not, if you were standing back, it isn't probably a job you'd want to go home and brag to your kids about.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, it's very, very needed. We're making great strides, and it's just another big problem. And I've dove into it. I've been there almost 3 years now.
Right, right.
And that's shocking. It seems like a minute ago that we started.
True. So in your life, have you seen that ever it happened that your disability, you know, stopped you from doing something?
Oh my gosh.
Or you slowed it down, because it seems like you are not slowing down. You are running.
I don't even think about my leg as a disability anymore. I don't have a disabled plate. That would be ridiculous. The only time I've ever claimed I was disabled is they were out of tickets to the Edgar Martinez retirement party, but they had room in ADA. So I said, I need to sit there.
Wow.
Sorry.
No, this is so positive attitude. Like,
yeah,
don't even think about it. And
it's not a disability. For me, it shouldn't be. For other people, it shouldn't be. There's times when physical things will hold you back.
True.
There is no doubt about that. But you can be the best that you can be that you're physically able to be.
True.
I have Ironman athlete friends that can do the full Ironman in between 10 and 11 hours. Maybe some of them faster than that.
Right.
But they're doing it to the maximum of their ability. I'm doing it to the maximum of mine. And you should have no regret as long as you do the best that you can do. I mean, if you're slacking and you're not putting an effort into something, you shouldn't expect to do the best that you can do.
True.
I've never looked at my leg as a disability. I do things sometimes a little bit differently.
Right.
When we change from strength exercises to running, I walk over and switch a leg.
Mm.
I've been very blessed with hanger prosthetics to come alongside me. I have people say, you're missing a leg. Which one? I've got six.
Yeah.
I've got two running legs. I've got two cycling legs. I've got two walking legs. And it's just over the years of accumulating them, and I haven't changed sizes, so the legs still fit. Although three of them are old, I would do an Ironman on them.
Right, right.
And so I've been very blessed there to have good prosthetics. I just did a clinic down at Nike with Challenged Athletes Foundation. Great charity. Shameless plug. And we were helping people who never had the opportunity to run, never knew how, never knew they could. And to see people light up when they get to do a little bit of this and right. realize that, hey, you can do this. You're not really enable to do this.
Right.
It's just super exciting to me. True. Super exciting to me. Yeah, we had quite a few athletes there that had done Ironman. One guy just came back from doing a half Ironman. We've had some marathon runners. One of the girls there did Kona. But the girl that came in, and I don't know her name, she came in a wheelchair and she had a prosthetic. She didn't really have a limb at all.
Mm.
Her prosthetic fit up underneath her.
Right.
And to get her moving faster than just a walk wow. was awesome. It wow. was probably the biggest event of the day to see her able to jog on this thing.
Wow.
More exciting than watching Nick and I run, for sure, because we run all the time.
True. So what is your favorite pastime? Like, what do you do in your free time?
Oh, my gosh. Play with programs? That's horrible. when I get some free time, I like working on things, fixing things. We have an RV, and mm-hmm. RVs are generally broken or, mm-hmm. or about to be broken. So mm-hmm. I just enjoy doing about anything that isn't too technical, where I don't have to think too hard. Right. I think the biggest thing for me is not putting my body in neutral, but putting my brain in neutral.
I guess.
When you sit all day long and you're trying to solve rather complex problems, after a while you don't want to think very hard. True. Sometimes I'll say something and my wife is, did you really just say that? I don't want to think today. I just turned it off.
true.
I love just building anything.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that we have a wood shop and a metal shop both down okay. where we live in Arizona part of the year. And mm-hmm. I love going in there, but I haven't had much time because I've been working.
Right.
The day's coming.
Hmm. Any favorite book of yours, favorite author, which affected your life in a big way?
Probably The Purpose-Driven Life is one. I don't read many books.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the Bible affected my life heavily, but that's mm-hmm. that's kind of fundamental. I had an interesting, somebody handed me a book of Warren Buffett's quotes.
Hmm.
I recommend it. It's a great, great book.
Hmm.
You know.
Okay.
He's one of my heroes in some senses. In the fact, not the fact that he's got the most money in the world or anything, but the way he lives his life.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I was a little sad to see some things about him, but mostly he's like down to earth. He doesn't try to do astronomical things.
Right.
And recently, the financial advice that he's been giving people is something I've been preaching for a long time. Is just don't make it complicated.
Right.
You're probably not in a position to do complicated things with a stock market.
Yes.
And to keep it simple and you'll be successful. And it's been so true for me that I know it's correct.
So today, what do you cherish most?
I think being content. I cherish my wife.
Mm-hmm.
She's awesome. I mean, without her, life really wasn't complete. But I guess I just cherish the fact that I can be content with life and not be doing things that I shouldn't be doing or chasing after things that aren't meaningful. But I'm very content with where my life is.
Perfect.
You know,
yeah.
I wouldn't mind being 30 years younger. I can't be that. I wouldn't mind being a few million more richer. And that's not going to be anything but destructive trying to get there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think being content is probably one of the things I cherish the most. I've got a great marriage. Financially, we're pretty well set, and I'm just very content with life.
Perfect.
And I'm still working. I mean,
right?
I don't have to, but yeah. It's more fun, I think. I think I'm actually probably doing a better job now that I don't really have to work.
Right.
But I am working.
Right. So after all this, you know, world experiences, do you fear anything anymore?
I guess it's always in the back of my mind is when is a joint going to go out, or when is something physically going to break down doing this crazy things. This may be destructive behavior that I'm not realizing.
Right.
But this morning was a nice short hour and a half workout where we did a lot of strength workout, and then I went out and ran for about 40 minutes. But there's going to be some day, I fear the day when I can't do it. But I also have the confidence in the days where I thought what I was doing was the most important thing in my life, and then I've had it disappear. Mm-hmm. So the contentment to know that the life changes and life is going to be okay, and that there's somebody higher than me looking out for me, is sure. giving me a kind of a peace of mind there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I fear like lots of things. I want to retire soon, and mm-hmm. how do you buy medical insurance? I have a lot of fears, but uh-huh. I think they're all pretty trivial. Okay. I think there's people with lots bigger fears in life than I have.
Okay. Last question. What you like about Microsoft?
Generally, the people that work here are driven. They're trying to get something done. My goodness, if you don't like the culture at Microsoft, you probably really don't belong here. You know, mm-hmm. we've got a lot of challenges, a lot of hard problems. And for me, that's just like a kid in a candy store. Mm-hmm. It's just one problem after another that I can go and tackle. Okay. Yesterday, I was confronted with a change in some code that I had written, and my first thought was to tense up, like, I don't want to do that mm-hmm. because I don't know anything about it. But 10 minutes later, I decided, wow, I get to go learn something new.
Right.
I think every day I learn something new. Mm-hmm. And I think that satisfies my being quite well. And that's what I like the most about it. I have met and worked with some of the most awesome people in the world.
Sure.
It has been a great journey.
Okay, perfect. Thank you very much for doing this, Ed. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome. It was a blast. Yeah. We should do it again.
Yes.